Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, we continue our conversations with retiring lawmakers. Senate Minority Leader Melissa Lopez-Franzen, longtime advocate for education Senator Chuck Wieger, and the remarkably accomplished Finance Chair Senator Julie Rosen. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. Melissa Lopez-Franzen was elected to the Senate in 2012 and was the first woman and the first DFLer to represent the suburban city of Edina and parts of Eden Prairie, Bloomington, and Minnetonka. Last fall, she became the first Latina to achieve a leadership role as Senate Minority Leader. She joins me now to reflect on her decade of service. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Shannon.
When you came to the Senate, you flipped a district. You were the first woman elected to the Senate representing Edina. And upon arrival in the Senate, you were the youngest member of your caucus. You said that you were given the advice to learn the job and keep quiet. In retrospect, was that good advice?
Well, learning the job, yes. And I think you learn it every year because every year has different challenges. But I did not keep quiet. I certainly made sure that my voice was at the table, but I did earn people's respect. So I think when you do talk in these forums, when you're new, it's learning a new job. And I took my time to learn the new job, build relationships with my colleagues that when I did speak up, they were listening.
Fast forward 9 years, last September, you were elected to the job of leader of the Senate DFL caucus, the first Latina elected to a leadership role in the Minnesota Senate. During your farewell speech, you said that it is a role that you did not plan for, but that you are grateful for. What has it taught you?
Well, Shannon, it's a job that has no job description other than you're the jack of all trades and the buck stops with you. So you are in charge of managing your caucus and being the voice for your caucus, which is very challenging when you have 31 of you and you all have your own perspectives on issues and policy. But it has taught me to be much more patient than I have been with my 5 and 7 year old, because you do have to manage through some challenges of whether it's an issue or some issues happening, whether it's policy related or tragedy related, whether it's something happening in your community. You just have to bring people together, and it takes time to do that, to build relationships, but also solve problems. So it's taught me a lot more patience, which is great, because we need to learn how to listen to each other better. That's, I guess, another aspect of it, learning to listen and everybody's perspective and bringing those voices to the table to solve those problems.
Throughout your Senate career, you have sometimes voiced more moderate views in keeping with the balance required of your district. What is the secret to representing a complex constituency?
A lot of work, and most of it is on your end to communicate to your constituency and to Minnesotans, because you're talking to all these people who are watching what you're doing on their behalf, and making sure that people know where you're coming from and if you took a vote, why, and making that conversation an open conversation. So I would send literally every week of session of my entire tenure a newsletter to my constituencies with a video, and that would open that conversation. A lot of times people say, get me off your list. Other times it's more like, I didn't like what you do, can we elaborate? And it actually helped build that trust with constituents, and I'd send it to more than just constituents, but I think that helped a lot building that relationship and that trust with my constituents.
And because you had more political diversity in your district, do you think that helped then when you did earn that leadership role?
Yes, absolutely. They knew that I would make the best decision, not just for the district, but also for the state. And yes, my role is for the caucus, but it's a bigger role when you're one of three people, when I'm talking about the House and Senate, and the governor, when you're making those deals and those decisions for the people of Minnesota. They trusted me to make the best decision. And they know that I come at it from a policy perspective more than a political perspective. So putting that lens on first of what's best for Minnesota, when we talked about reinsurance, which is an issue that I personally don't think it's the best solution to solve healthcare, but I knew the importance of that at the moment.
You voiced caution to your Senate colleagues in the last day of session during your farewell speech about the fragility of democracy, noting that early in your Senate career, the relationships between DFL and GOP lawmakers were stronger than they are now. You also said that you are less optimistic than you once were. In your view, what will it take to fix the divisiveness that is part of politics today?
Well, and I think we need to look at it from a historical standpoint. I just finished reading a book, Why We Are Polarized, by Ezra Klein, and it just refocused the issue of how we became polarized. And it's not just in the Minnesota Senate, it's across the country. And bringing the lens of history and data points and how people are changing in their issues, it just makes it more, it makes you understand the issues more of why we're here, where we're at. I think what it's going to take is to have more conversations with each other, to really listen. We were isolated, maybe you can blame COVID, but we have been isolated politically, and we need to bring people who are coming up to serve in public service and to do it like I am. I'm doing it for 10 years and I'm finding my way out, maybe not because I wanted to, but I know there's another place for me to serve, and having more people coming into public service, whether it's elected or in another form, having great candidates, I think that's something that I have been really focused on in this latest cycle of election coming up. So just bringing more voices to the table and bringing people and not censoring them, having those dialogues and respectful and civil discourse.
A healthy balance between work life and personal life is particularly hard to come by during legislative sessions. As a parent of young children during your tenure, you mentioned your 5- and 7-year-old, has the culture of the Senate become more accommodating to people with young families or aging parents or, you know, familial challenges? Are there specific changes that you would recommend?
Well, it's gotten better, but even when you take on roles in leadership, your time becomes even more constrained. So having a village of people supporting you during this last session, which was my first as leader, I had a kid who had to go to therapy, and sometimes I would have to run literally from the chamber, go to Edina, come back to St. Paul in the middle of votes. And thankfully we have remote voting, so that was that was something that we were able to use, and members from other parts of the state could be dealing with whatever personal issues they would have. But I think we still need that flexibility. I was just asked today whether we're gonna have flexible hearings for committees. I think we should, not just for members, but also for the public to have access to what we're doing.
So some of the changes that happened because of COVID, you would like to see ongoing because they perhaps allow for a better work-life balance for lawmakers.
Absolutely, and not to abuse them. They would surely have to be some parameters around it so people don't abuse them, but even for having people to come and testify on a bill to do our job that can't drive here, that can't have access to the Capitol, but live in Bemidji, Minnesota, we wanna make sure that they're able to participate. So yes, I think some of those things should be a constant, and we should adapt to the technologies of the world.
Finally, you were not ready to leave the Senate. You've said as much. And in fact, it seemed that your star was still rising. Unfortunately, you made the tough decision not to run for re-election because, unfortunately, you were redistricted with a DFL colleague. So what's next for you?
That's a question I've been getting a lot lately, and one of the things I know is I'm going to go back to my other job. This is a part-time legislature, and many of us have another job. I'm an attorney by trade, and I have a small business, so I'll go back to that. I also will have the chance to be a professor, so I'll be teaching at the University of Minnesota, and I'm excited for the next chapter. I'm 42 years old. I have a long runway, whether in politics or not, but I will assure you I won't be too far away from politics. It's an important job, and I've learned a lot. And I don't want to be away from it. I'm not going to hide in a cave.
Senator Melissa Lopez Franzen, it is a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shannon.
Senator Chuck Wieger was elected to the Senate in 1996, and throughout his 26 years of service was always a member of an education committee, including 6 years as chair. He joins me now to reflect on his 2.5 decades as a lawmaker. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shannon.
So you have a very unique personal story, which you told on the Senate floor during your farewell speech, and I would encourage our viewers to go look that up. But in short, in your youth, you were a runaway. You did odd jobs. You even joined the circus for a time. What influence did your own story have on your desire to advocate for education?
Well, it was a remarkable journey, a risky journey, dropping out, and I don't recommend it. I was fortunate that I made it. But I learned a lot about people. I learned a lot about myself. And part of the bottom line was that the passport for future opportunity rests in getting an education, advancing in my education. That 10th grade wouldn't be quite enough. And I always was relatively confident in my ability to succeed in school, but it was more wanting to discover other things in the United States and also in the world. I worked on a ship too for a while. And so, you know, a number of stepping stones were a part of my education, but it made clear that the passport to future opportunity is to get a great education, to apply yourself to the best you can, which eventually I did do.
So you wanted to see the world for yourself. You had a bit of wanderlust, which, as we were talking about, you still have. I wonder, though, are there services that exist in public schools today for students that weren't available to you at that time that maybe would have helped you stay in school?
The new programs, and we've had them now for, you know, several years, would be for post-secondary education options, PSEO, being able to take college courses in high school, I think is a great opportunity to keep students engaged in, you know, their education. Sometimes they might be bored or not sufficiently challenged. I was not challenged to the extent that I wanted to be in high school. There's other reasons too for why I traveled, but I definitely would have found it more appealing if there would have been programs like PSEO or Advanced Placement, things where you could have bridged that next stepping stone for higher education with your high school experience. So I've worked quite a bit on these programs, have advanced them, and have shared a little bit about my own experience. And I can assure you, each of my five kids, was a participant in that, and as our grandkids now, as they get close to that age.
Political topics have always come up in debates about education policies, prayer in schools, or whether and how sex education should be taught. Come to mind of recent debates. But most recent concerns that have been raised by parents and politicians have to do with parents' rights, as well as concerns over how some subjects are actually taught. Are teachers and students now in the crosshairs of some of these cultural issues?
Absolutely. Across America, this is a huge battle that's being waged. It's being waged in my district as well, in some of the current school board elections. There's been some great local coverage about Minnesota and school board races, and there is a sharp division. People have a right to express those opinions, and wherever you come down, it's up to that local school board to make a decision. The care, control, and management of that district rests with the school board. I served as a board member for nearly 20 years, chaired a board before coming to the Senate. And so you have a very important responsibility to the students in preparing them to the best of their ability, but in recognizing that parents have rights as well. They certainly can weigh in on what is being taught, and there are many ways that we have shared in our Senate committees where you can provide input in what the school district and ultimately what the teachers are doing. But unfortunately, there's been teachers that have been victims, they've been fired for teaching courses that in other districts, it is encouraged. It may be encouraged in their building, this freedom of speech. And so it is definitely having an impact on the future for some of the teachers that even want to enter the profession. But right now it's on the ballot in many districts throughout our state and our country.
As I'm sure you are aware, the most recent release of Minnesota's test data shows the degree to which the COVID-19 pandemic and distance learning has adversely impacted the state students. What needs to happen in order to get these students back on track?
Need to do a big focus on remediation, on the recovery, and I would assume that every school district, every charter school, private schools as well, they're talking about to the extent that it's needed. And each case is different. Each student is different. And so a key in putting together the developmental recovery programs is an individualized program for each student. It's not one size fits all. There's recovery money from the federal government that is intended to help in this effort. We're not having any Senate hearings on what is being done right now. I wish we were doing that, though I recognize there's campaigning that is superseding that. But it's a very important discussion that's going on. We have to remember, though, that in addition to the student performance, which has been impacted, not all students, by the way. In fact, some have thrived in this environment. But for those that haven't, which is too many, we need to double down on the remediation recovery efforts. And that means additional investment in the reading core and math core in tutors for the teachers that specialize in these areas and looking at what's being taught in the higher ed in preparing these teachers, something that we have been talking about and need to continue to have a sharp focus on.
We've talked on this program before about the need to educate the whole child, taking into account a student's access to food, a safe place to live, and their emotional and mental health. Yes. Is this perhaps one of the biggest changes that has occurred in education over the past, say, quarter century?
It's a significant change. There, you know, these issues have been there before, but not talked about. You know, we know that a student in poverty particularly is more at risk of not learning as well as others that might be of more advantage, that may have access to specialized programs and et cetera. But if a student is hungry, has an empty stomach, it's going to affect their learning. My former Senator Alice Johnson, she worked so hard in this and trying to make the breakfast available, and we prevailed on that. The mental health needs, pre-COVID mental health issues were the number one issue identified by teachers, by staff, by parents, and it's still there. It's out in the open now. It's good. It's important that we talk about it, and that we, most importantly, that we do something about it. And that means having counselors and other resource professionals, you know, social workers, etc., that can help in addressing these mental health issues. So to different degrees, these were issues before, but it's out in the open now, and it does impact learning. So
just briefly before we have to go, I want to return back again to your farewell speech, because you said to your colleagues, quote, "I could say very nice things about each of you." And you were talking not to just DFLers, but to Republicans also. So what's your best advice to this incoming group of lawmakers? It's going to be one of the largest in history. What's your best advice?
Well, my advice is to actively listen. You learn when you're listening, and not when you're talking necessarily, but when you're listening, and learn as much as you can about the other colleagues in the room. Of course, you want to take care of yourself and your family and, you know, the people in your district, stay in touch, etc. But key to how productive you're going to be as a legislator is the relationships that you establish within your own caucus and across the aisle, whether you're in the majority or the minority. So actively reach out, get to know people, be kind, actively listen, and be a part of the Purple Caucus, the blue-red working together. And it's 4 years from now for the new group when you're up for election. Just try to get along and focus on what you think is best, and you'll make some very good accomplishments.
Senator Chuck Wieger, best of luck to you. Thank you for your service.
Thank you, Shan. Thank you for your service.
Senator Senator Julie Rosen has played a pivotal role in combating drug abuse, reforming pensions, and keeping the Vikings here in Minnesota. We spoke in August about her 20 years in the Senate, and I began by asking her about her perspective on the Vikings Stadium.
Actually, it was the House, Representative Maury Lanning, and Governor Dayton. And the three of us did not move without the other two being okay with what we did. It was an amazing piece of legislation, a lot of work, because there was some people that didn't believe the Vikings would be looking at another territory, which they, as history shows, LA was open and they could have moved and they were looking at moving. So they are the fabric of Minnesota, one of the fabrics of Minnesota, and we put together a very good deal that was great for Minneapolis, for the city, and for the Vikings, and now we have a state-of-the-art, incredible stadium that's very beneficial to all of us, especially the state, and we should be very proud of that piece of property.
Yeah. You also led the charge to get some major reforms in the pension system implemented back in 2018. The state was paying out more than it was taking in, and with the aging baby boomers, the tsunami, the silver tsunami coming, it was only going to get worse. And you have cited pension reform as one of your top accomplishments. Why was this so important to you?
Well, don't tell anybody, but I really love pensions. It's kind of a wonky thing, but so critical to the state to have a solid, viable, healthy pension plan going forward. And we need to protect our state workers. They work very hard, whether it's our teachers, our firefighters, our police officers, our state workers. Everybody works very hard, so we had to stabilize those funds. And that was a joint effort. It was shared sacrifice, all those great terms, but that bill was extremely important. It couldn't have come at a better time. We were kind of on our last leg there. And we showed the rest of the nation that it can be done, pension reform, with everybody coming to the table and working on it, and we did.
Early in your Senate career, you led the Minnesota Methamphetamine Task Force, which resulted in passage of major anti-meth legislation in 2005. Considering the breadth of the legislation that you have shepherded over these 20 years now in the Senate, was it that early experience in tackling meth that gave you the tools and the understanding that you needed to become such a successful lawmaker?
Oh, well, thank you. Absolutely. Meth had landed in my district, Southern Minnesota. They had made a significant child endangerment law change in Iowa, so all the meth cooks were coming into Southern Minnesota. I had not a clue how to handle it, but got together about 35 people twice a month over 9 months to develop the largest methamphetamine bill in the nation. And we passed it all at once. And that's what's significant, because most states peel off one issue at a time. It had not only put the Sudafedrin behind the counter to stop the meth cooks, it worked on child endangerment, it worked on remediation of contaminated property, it worked on disclosure of contaminated property, it worked on treatment and making some safe harbor homes, some for meth homes for mothers with children, addicted mothers. It was an incredible piece of legislation. Could not have passed that without the help of all of the players, the retailers, the judges, police officers, the nonpartisan staff, our staff. It just went on and on. But also my colleagues from across the aisle. And Senator Berglund calls me up one Saturday morning and we're chit-chatting and she says, well, how's the meth bill coming? And I said, good. And she goes, well, I'd like to help you with it. And I said, you're not going to take that bill from me, are you? And she goes, no, you need help passing this. You can't get this passed without my help. And I realized at that time, you need to ask and you need to reach across the aisle, whether you're in the majority or the minority. That was a significant lesson right there.
On another drug front, you were instrumental in the establishment in 2019 of licensing fees on opioid distributors and manufacturers to begin raising additional funding to tackle the societal ramifications of opioid abuse. And those funds have been and are still being used mm-hmm. to fund treatment and county services. Is Minnesota now on the right track in tackling opioid abuse?
We are on a very, very solid path going forward, and we've laid a very good foundation with that bill. I have a very soft spot in my heart for children that are in abusive situations because of drug addiction. And I think that's because of the methamphetamine bill. So took the opioid issues head on with a lot of colleagues on both sides of the aisle to address that. And we did an outstanding bill with the help of you know, the executive branch. I mean, it was an incredible piece of legislation. Have great faith that we are tackling that issue, and we have the resources that are available and more resources coming, and we have a system to make sure that we can get the relief out.
Now, in a couple answers here, you've spoken of working across the aisle and group efforts to get big legislation done. Is that potentially a message to future people who will be coming to the legislature?
Absolutely. Do not feel too comfortable in your seat, whether you're in the minority or majority. And you cannot get anything substantial done here at this Capitol without knowing your colleagues and working across the aisle. And if I can give one piece of advice, go to people's offices and sit down and talk to them in their environment, in their situation. When you have a bill and you need signatures, go personally to them and ask for them to sign on to the bill. Make sure you explain the bill, why you're passionate about this, why you're doing it, and you develop a relationship. It's been very difficult the last couple years with our the COVID pandemic and this lack of communication and looking at each other in the eyes. But those personal one-on-one skills are so critical to getting anything done here.
And relatedly, in a 2012 article in the Mankato Free Press, author Mark Fishnick pointed out that you are, quote, virtually never in the middle of the partisan warfare that draws TV time and other media coverage. Has that been intentional on your part? And would the state benefit from more lawmakers focusing on the work and not on the politics?
I think that he's probably giving me more credit than is due, but yeah, I think it was intentional that I don't want to waste my time with the partisan politics. The majority of my term has been raising children, and I left children at home for 6 months out of the year. So I had to stay very focused on what my priorities were for the district here at the Capitol and what was best for the entire state. I wish more legislators understood that. We've had this wave of people that have come in and really have taken it to extremes on either side. So, you know, you have to work with people, and you have to compromise. And that's been my goal. I'm not gonna waste my time, my family's time, by being a partisan.
Have you accomplished what you set out to do in 2002 when you first came here?
Absolutely, absolutely, Shannon. I can walk away and say, we did good, and I can tell my family that your sacrifice was worth it, because a lot of good legislation happened on my watch and the watch of other people too, but thank you very much. And I can go back to my constituents and say, you believed in me, and I appreciate that so very much. They are the best people in the world, and hopefully I served you well. In fact, I know I served you well.
Senator Julie Rosen, I want to thank you for your service, and I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Shannon. It's been great working with you.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.